this is In Dark Places. Cryptopalooza. Paula, he never goes out of style. There are so many crazy cryptids out there in the world, we're just going to do a whole episode on cryptids this week. And we even have cryptid news. Here's my friend, Mr. Haunted. In his presence, we
this story comes in from our friend Lon Strickler of phantomsandmonsters.com. This is fresh news from February 22nd. A bat-winged humanoid observed a North Carolina resident's roof. An Orange County, North Carolina resident was in his backyard at night when he observed a dark-winged humanoid clawing itself up the roof of his house. It reached the gable, then suddenly flew off. I received a telephone call from DP in reference to a winged humanoid encounter by his friend CV on Saturday, February 19th of this year at approximately 9:30 p.m. local time. The location was a residential neighborhood in Orange County, North Carolina, about 30 minutes northwest of Raleigh. We connected in a three-way conference call in which CV described his encounter. CV was in his backyard walking about, not bothering anybody, la-di-da-da, thinking about work-related issues. The moon was near the horizon, but bright enough for the witness to make out shadows and landscape details. As he turned towards the house, a two-story federal-style home with a one-and-a-half-story garage attached, he heard scratching sounds coming from the roof of the house. As he looked up, and within 50 feet of him, he observed a dark, thin body clawing itself towards the top of the roof. The movement was similar to that of a bat. CV watched as the being reached the gable of the roof, crouched at the top, and sat there for a few seconds. It then suddenly jettisoned into the air without the use of its wings. CV estimates that the body was 5.5 to 6 feet in height, fully extended. The wings, which were partially opened, were membraned like that of a bat, with defined claws attached to the top. CV never observed the face since it was looking away from him. There was no sound associated with the beast. CV and DP were fascinated by the timing of the encounter, since both of them had been discussing the 1966-67 Point Pleasant Mothman sightings in recent days. DP has also been reading John Keel's Mothman prophecies. As they began to research the Mothman and winged humanoid creatures online, they discovered the Phantoms and Monsters Fortean Research investigation of the Chicago winged humanoids, which neither had previously known about. The witness and his friend are both professional and well-regarded businessmen. I am actively researching for additional sightings in the Raleigh, North Carolina area. So, if anybody saw anything like this recently, go to our friend Lon's page. It's phantomsandmonsters.com. You can also find him on Facebook. Thanks, Lon.
Australian driver films Tasmanian Tiger by Tim Banal. Thanks, Tim. A motorist cruising down a city street in Australia filmed a curious creature dashing along a sidewalk, and some suspect that the odd animal could be the legendary Tasmanian tiger. The wild video, which can be seen in the show notes, was captured earlier this month by a man in the Melbourne suburb of Strathmore, and subsequently wound up being posted to TikTok shortly after the eerie encounter. In the footage, his drive down a desolate road takes an unexpected turn when two passengers in the car excitedly asked, "What is that?" when they see a strange creature lingering in the road. Upon spotting what his two companions noticed, the man exclaims, "Oh my God!" And a caption in the video wonders if the creature is an extinct Tassie tiger, the animal in question, which the witness aptly describes as very weird and aged. appears to sport the iconic stripes of the creature and quickly scrambles up onto a sidewalk. Amazingly, the video then cuts to the driver having exited his vehicle in pursuit of the suspected Tasmanian tiger. Clearly not too keen on being caught, the creature quickens its pace and runs away from the man, although it's still close enough to be seen on the video. Although in the footage he marvels that he is chasing the Tasmanian tiger, the caption to the video concedes that it could be just a very sick fox. The chase culminates with the creature vanishing into a field as the motorist lets out a rather colorful response to the unknown animal disappearing into the darkness of the night. Reaction to the footage has been largely divided, with some viewers saying that the critter could be proof that the creature may not actually be extinct. However, others argue that the animal is most likely a fox or dog suffering from mange, which are actually the sort of mystery creatures that get confused for chupacabras in other parts of the world. Before we get to Cryptopalooza, here is the Nicolas Cage Meltdown of the Week.
No! You're gonna get him out! You're gonna get him out!
Kicking off Cryptopalooza, here is my friend, Mr. Haunted.
Cryptopalooza show. It's probably the best show ever. So the Dover Demon is a small humanoid reported from Dover, Massachusetts. It was the subject of an intensive scare during the 1970s when multiple witnesses came forward with their sightings. The Dover Demon is described as looking sort of like a gray variety of alien, except that it has skin of a rosy orange instead of sickly gray. The Dover Demon has a large head on a small stick-like body. It can be bipedal, but it often travels on all fours or switches back and forth between the two modes of locomotion. It has eyes that glow, sometimes orange, sometimes green. It does not seem to wear any clothing, unless the clothing fits tightly and it's the same color as its body. Unlike the grays, the Dover Demon does not seem to be associated with UFOs. It just wanders around on its own. Cryptozoologists seldom show interest in the Dover Demon, the poor little fella. Mainstream cryptologists are rarely willing to seriously investigate humanoids other than hairy humanoids. It seems that sightings only happened during a short time period, with most claiming that sightings have now ceased, so the Dover Demon does not seem to be a pressing matter. And here's a sighting for you. The bizarre tale begins at 10:32 p.m. on April 21st. I think this was back in 1977. As three 17-year-olds, Bill Bartlett, Mike Mazzocca, and Andy Brody, are driving north on Farm Street, Bartlett, who's behind the wheel of a Volkswagen, spots something creeping along a low wall of loose stones on the left side of the road. At first, he thinks the image is a dog or a cat, until his headlights shine on it, and he realizes it's nothing he's ever seen before. The figure slowly turns its head and stares into the light. It's two large, round, glassy, lidless eyes, shining brightly like two orange marbles, were his exact words. Its watermelon-shaped head, resting at the top of a thin neck, is the size of the rest of his body. Except for the oversized head, the creature is thin. The long, spindly arms and legs, and large hands and feet. The skin is hairless and peach-colored, and appears to have a rough texture, like wet sandpaper, Bartlett said. Standing no more than 3.5 to 4 feet tall, The figure is shaped like a baby's body with long arms and legs. It had been making its way along the wall, its long fingers curling around the rocks when the car lights surprised it. Unfortunately, neither of Bartlett's companions sees the creature. The sighting lasts only for a few seconds, and before Bartlett can speak, the car leaves the scene. Then the creature is gone. Bartlett drops his friends off and goes to his Walpole Street home. Visibly upset, he walks through the door, and his father asks him what's wrong. Bartlett relates the story and later sketches what he's seen. Around midnight, 15-year-old John Baxter leaves his girlfriend Kathy Cronin's house at the south end of Miller High Road. Then Baxter starts walking up the street on his way home. Half an hour later, after he walked about a mile, he observes someone approaching them. Because the figure is short, Baxter assumes it's his acquaintance of his, M.G. Bouchard, who lives on the street. John calls out, no response. Baxter and the figure continue to approach each other until finally the latter stops. Baxter then halts as well and asks, "Who is that?" The sky is dark and overcast and he can only see a shadowy form. Trying to get a better look, Baxter takes one step forward and the figure scurries off to the left, running down a shallow wooded gully and up the opposite bank. As the figure runs, Baxter hears its footsteps on the dry leaves. He follows the figure down the slope, then stops and looks across the gully. There he sees the creature standing in silhouette about 30 feet away, its feet molded around the top of a rock several feet from a tree. The creature's body reminds Baxter of a monkey's, except for its figure-eight-shaped head, its eyes, and two lighter marks in the middle of his head. Looking straight at Baxter, who after a few minutes begins to feel uneasy, realizing he has never seen such a creature before, and fearing what it might do next, he backs carefully up the slope, his heart pounding. He then walks very fast down the road to the intersection of Farm Street. There, a couple passing in a car pick him up and drive him home. The Dover Demon. Another 15-year-old, Abby Brabham, claimed to have seen the creature the following night on Springdale Avenue. The creatures all drew sketches of the alleged creature. Bartlett wrote on his sketch, "I, Bill Bartlett, swear on a stack of Bibles that I saw this creature." According to the Boston Globe, the location of the sightings plotted on a map lay in a straight line over 2 miles. Some suggest that the creature may have been a foal or a moose calf. Why does it have to be a foal or a moose calf? Why can't it just be the Dover Demon? Back after this.
Memories press between the pages of my mind.
And as you know, I usually have some kind of a personal story to tie in with just about every topic we cover on here. Kind of weird. And this episode is no different. Back in March of 2002, I was driving back and forth to Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia. I think about 3 days a week. And one day, I want to say it was like March 31st of 2002. I can't remember the exact day. It was in March. I was on my way back home, making the long 2-hour journey back from Huntington. And right before I got into Croom, West Virginia, which is a hot spot we've talked about before, I was coming down a high mountain in my little blue 1995 Chevy Beretta. And I looked off to the right side of the road. There's a little wide spot area where a whole lot of nothing happens. Some electrical poles and stuff like that. I guess the area is kind of cleared off for those guys to do their work. But I was coming down the hill and I looked over to my right and I saw this big, humongous creature standing on the side of the road. It was in broad daylight and it was standing there staring at me. And I slowed down. I was going like 60 miles per hour. I slowed down to like 10 miles per hour looking at this thing, trying to get an idea of what in the world it was. It was bigger than a cow. And it had hair like Snuffleupagus. You know that guy from Sesame Street with the cool long brown hair? His hair looked just like that. This guy had hair like Snuffleupagus. And it wasn't quite as big as an elephant or a Snuffleupagus, but it was bigger than a cow. And it had the weirdest face I've ever seen in my life. It had like a big, flat face. It was about the size of a garbage can lid. Big old flat face. It was looking at me, trying to figure out what I am. And I was looking at it, trying to figure out what it was. We were just staring at each other. And for some reason, I got the thought that it was going to charge at me. So I floored it and got out of there. I wish I would have pulled off the side of the road and took some pictures or something. Didn't have a camera with me in those days. I was thinking, as I was staring at this thing, you poor, ugly creature. Because it was pretty homely looking. And I want to say it could have been a buffalo, maybe, but I don't think it was. Something just seemed off about it. And besides that, there's not supposed to be any wild buffalo running around in West Virginia anymore. So I don't know what that thing was, but it was ugly.
This one's called A Tree Squeak, and there isn't much information on it, but I found this interview with a TV show, so I'm going to go back and forth between the interviewer and this man named Jack Dudley. So first, the interviewer says, "Ever heard of a tree squeak? Well, on foggy nights, on the full moon, you might find them moving around in the trees near Pocomo Moonshine Lake in Maine." Jack Dudley lives on the shores of the lake, and he's on the line with us now. Mr. Dudley, what's a tree squeak? Jack Dudley. It's a small animal. They run from the largest I've ever seen has been about 9 inches long, counting the tail. They run from there down to probably 6.5 inches, just like all other mammals. They vary in size. What does it look like? Well, probably the closest thing between them would possibly be a flying squirrel, but they are not a squirrel. They don't have legs. They have suction cups. Suction cups. On the sides of the bellies, and by the use of the suction cups, they're able to travel around the trees. They cannot travel on the ground. Why not? If one falls on the ground, he dies of starvation. He can't move. They can travel around in trees. That's one of the reasons the number of them is so restricted, because their range is restricted. They're in the hardwoods. Usually find them on a hardwood ridge, but they're not very numerous. I have seen very few in my lifetime. The interviewer, about how many are there, do you think? Jack Dudley says, well, I would say they probably should be described as an endangered species. We have them here in eastern Washington County, a few, and I know that you have a few of them in southern New Brunswick over in Charlotte County. Gee, I've never heard of them here. The Museum of Natural History in St. John, they have a publication they put out, and they had an article in that about a year ago about them. The interviewer, when did you first discover tree squeaks? Oh, I've known them. I've known about them for about probably 25 years or more. Has anyone else ever seen one? Well, I have a mounted specimen here. The interviewer, oh. I had three brought to me one winter back here a number of years ago. A Mi'kmaq Indian lives over in the back of St. Stephen's brought them into me. He found them on the ground in the snow, and of course they were frozen solid. Nothing in their digestive tracts. They'd starve to death, and I mounted all three of them. And I have one specimen here. The other two I gave away. Interviewer, how many of them have you seen in 25 years? Oh, in my life, I haven't seen more than probably 8 to 10 in my lifetime. How long have you been cataloging things like tree squeaks? All my life. All your life? Yes, all my life. I was well acquainted with Colonel Ritchie up in Fredericton, and I knew Bruce Wright, who used to be the director of the wildlife station there. Northeastern Wildlife Station. I've been into this stuff since I was a kid. Has this been a hobby or a full-time job for you? Oh, no. Hobby. I'm a retired attorney. I'd certainly like to see one of these tree squeaks. I guess I'm going to have to get down to Charlotte County and take a look. Back to Jack Dudley. Well, I have one here. Doug Daw, who was one of your foresters over in New Brunswick, he's seen it. The only way they can get from tree to tree is after you have a windstorm or something, and there are windfalls. They can cross over on a fallen tree, cross on the fallen tree from one tree to the next, and then at sometimes in the summer, during the hot weather, when you have a lot of humidity in the air, you could get a full moon, and they can travel from one tree to another on moonbeams. The interviewer laughs now. You may think it's foolish, but it isn't. They have developed a train over in Munich, Germany, that is in experimental stages, and that train travels on a layer of air. Surely if a train can travel on a layer of air, a tree squeak, which only weighs 3 or 4 ounces, probably the biggest ones if they weigh that much, surely they can travel on a moonbeam. Interviewer, sort of like hovercraft? Jack Dudley, yes, you go out on your lakes or ponds and you will see all kinds of insects walking on the water. They don't break through. Mother Nature has provided many good things, which a lot of people don't. They develop something scientifically and they think they've done something new. Mother Nature's been doing it for years. Why are tree squeaks an endangered species? Does someone trap them for their fur? Jack Dudley. Well, they live primarily on the hardwood ridges, and the hardwood ridges used to be, which wasn't much demand for hardwood. But now, of course, the paper companies, they're using hardwood now to manufacture paper, and they're using it to manufacture veneer, plywood, so there's more demand. And then, of course, in recent years, we've had several of these insect epidemics. We had one here a few years ago that killed all the beech off. Same thing as you got now in the spruce. Spruce budworm, spruce and fir. But it's because of their habitat, because of their limited liability, limited ability to move around. All other birds and mammals that we have, if you get an epidemic or catastrophe or a forest fire or something, they can move over into adjoining territory and survive, but tree squeaks can't. Interviewer, Mr. Dudley, thank you very much. You're entirely welcome. Bye-bye. So Jack Dudley says, if you're ever up in St. Stephen or in this area, why, you can come out and see this one. Interviewer, okay, I'll do that. Thank you. You're welcome. Goodbye. That was Jack Dudley of Polka Moonshine Lake in Maine, talking about tree squeaks.
Thanks again, UFO Fred. Never heard of a tree squeak before.
Aerial manta rays. Flying through the air with their toothless mouths open wide and intermittently closing, aerial manta rays swim over areas near water at night. They phase into the atmosphere, lingering for a time, before dissipating, traveling elsewhere. The beings, when seen, display grace and complexity in their flight patterns, making tight turns, wide arches, deep dives, and figure eight turnarounds. Their smooth, plump bodies are described as being larger than a car, with gray skin, a short tail, and flat triangular wings connecting seamlessly to the body without feathers or hair, and coming to a point as they glide, their wings stretch and retract like a rubber band being pulled and then abruptly released. Though color is noticeable on the creature in the dark, in the light it becomes translucent and takes on a glow like a jellyfish. The wings, head, and tail are more transparent than its core. While wavering, as if in the water, not flapping like a bird, the creature filter feeds consuming insects, pollen, and other airborne particles. The first thing typically seen in flying ray encounters are their tiny round eyes above the corners of their mouth, which are orange, glowing red, and are located on the being's underside. Some report feeling pulses of sound near the creatures. They communicate in low tone patterns, dubbed Birost by alien researchers. All sightings last less than 15 minutes and are comprised of seeing the creature fly, eat, and disappear. An interstellar traveler, it visits Earth to meet some of its needs and is usually harmless. Usually.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. Since we've no place to go.
Oh, great.
Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
You know, it doesn't show the snow's already dangerous. If you're walking about in the snow, you could fall and be injured. If you're driving, you know, there's tons of accidents because of the snow. But apparently we have to be aware of something else now. The snow snake! The snow snake is a fearsome critter which originates in North American pioneer folklore. Said to have migrated down from Siberia via the Bering Strait during a particularly cold winter, snow snakes hibernate during the summer but become active throughout the freezing winter months, their natural pigmentation enabling them to conceal themselves more easily when the land is covered in snow. They have a body which is purest white in color and a highly venomous bite. A snow snake's preferred method of hunting is to sit coiled atop a snowdrift where its natural camouflage makes it all but invisible. Once a suitable victim comes within range, it will strike with an astonishing speed, its potent bite quickly incapacitating its prey. Snow snakes rarely attack humans, considering them too large to eat. But if a poor, unfortunate soul is bitten by a snow snake, the only known antivenom is Tanglefoot. For example, Junebug, I've been bitten by a snow snake. Do you have any Tanglefoot on hand? No, Jimmy, I don't. And thanks to UFO Fred for sending us the idea of sharing the snow snake story with you. Cryptopalooza. It's a hoot.
Blue Grimms are fairies that aid in decomposition, help bring in winter, and live where the dead reside. They smell of rotten flesh and have the appearance of an emaciated, dying creature, but are living, magical, malicious entities. It is unknown how they came into being, though they are viewed as forces of nature, ever present and undying. These tiny beings can be found where human remains are buried. Groups of them can be discovered in cemeteries, but gatherings can also be found in any site where multiple bodies are buried. Few may even loiter at the location of one corpse. However, blue grims eventually congregate in graveyards, and they are fervently drawn to them, called to carry out their duties and fulfill innate desires. Grave pucks have short, white, or gray hair parted by a pale gray horn. Their skin is the same deathly pale color, and it is cracked or leathery, sunken over a bone frame, and seemingly devoid of any kind of muscles. Where eyes should be, deep dark depressions lie instead, the skin twisting into its skull. Above the holes are small ovular eyebrows, usually furrowed. Below is an angular face with gaunt, pronounced cheekbones and thin lips that cover a mouthful of sharp teeth. Blue grims have skeletal bodies with pronounced features. 5 phalanged, each back toe is opposable, gripping perches or acting as a dagger to foes. The fae also have a pair of dark blue bat-like wings, but they are mostly useless in their state of decay. The wing's membrane, which is dotted with tears and holes, only permits the fae to gain height on a jump or flutter to the ground with clumsy, unnerving movement. As is ear length, the number of gaps in a puck's wing denotes their age, allowing their body to float with a jump. Blue Grimm's bones are lightweight. Those located in the wings are just hollow. The entities live for about 70 years on average.
Let me introduce you individuals to the Bildad. He is a fearsome critter, let me tell you. The Bildad lives only around Boundary Pond in northwest Maine. He's a piece of war who eats mainly fish, and it hunts by wading by grassy areas with lots of insects. When a fish surfaces to try to eat a bug, the Bildad will jump over it with astonishing speed and smack its tail down hard enough to stun the fish, which the creature eats soon after. The smack sound, similar to paddling and canoers, are sometimes mistaken for the Bildad, and vice versa. The Bildad was considered to be a delicacy by lumberjacks until very recently, but no one knows what the meat tastes like because the Bildad is very shy and reclusive. However, a reported instance stated that a dead Bildad was washed ashore and a cook made a meal out of it to be eaten by a certain fellow named Bill Murphy. However, as soon as the person ate the meat, he felt sick, his eyes glazed over, and he ran outside and imitated a Bildad. This part is mostly this part is most likely exaggerated by locals. In the 2015 remake of Fearsome Creatures, the Bildad is remade to be a bird. The scientific name is Castor saltissimus, and the bird's flesh is the source of reverse lycanthropy, as if a human eats Bildad meat, even when tainted with poisonous castor oil, they will turn into a Bildad. And that reminds me of a story about Chinese food I got for you, coming up after this.
The Chupacabra is a legendary creature in folklore of parts of the Americas, with his purported sightings reported in Puerto Rico in 1995. The name comes from the animal's reported vampirism. The chupacabra is said to attack and drink the blood of livestock, including goats, and its name means goat sucker in Spanish. Physical descriptions of the creature may vary, with some describing it as more dog-like, while most others describe it as reptilian or alien-like. Some report it as being a heavy creature about the size of a small bear, with a row of spines reaching from the neck to the base of the tail. Sightings have been reported in Puerto Rico since the 1970s, and this creature has since been reported as far north as Maine, or as far south as Chile, and even outside the Americas in countries like Russia and the Philippines. All the reports are anecdotal and have been disregarded as uncorroborated or lacking evidence. Sightings in northern Mexico and the southern United States have been verified as canids afflicted by mange. According to biologists and wildlife management officials, the chupacabra is an urban legend.
Breaking news! Legs, fingers amputated after leftover Chinese food infects student in Boston, Massachusetts. A 19-year-old student ate some leftover Chinese food, takeout food, from a restaurant. There's nothing unusual about this, but what happens next can only be described as bizarre and tragic. All at once, hours after having the leftover meal, the person had to have both of his legs and all of his fingers amputated. The student, identified only as JC in the New England Journal of Medicine, had developed life-threatening sepsis and gangrene caused by bacteria in the food. He was admitted to the pediatric intensive care unit of the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. The patient had been well until 20 hours before this admission, when abdominal pain and nausea developed after he ate rice, chicken, and lo mein leftovers from a restaurant meal, the journal stated. As per the New York Post, the person was a part-time worker at the restaurant After eating the leftovers from the unnamed Chinese outlet, he immediately started throwing up. This was followed by chills, shortness of breath, headache, blurry vision, and chest pain. A friend of the patient said that his skin had started to turn purple. After a series of blood and urine tests, it was revealed that the patient was suffering from a bacterial infection called Neisseria meningitidis. It was also diagnosed with sepsis, which was triggered by the infection and also caused him to develop gangrene. Following this, the 19-year-old had to have all of his fingers and both legs amputated. I have no words. For once.
Wow. The corpse walker is possibly the most horrendous creature West Virginia has to offer. It differs from a traditional Wendigo in four major ways. Number one, it has a human head instead of an animal-like head. Number two, it is birthed after a Wendigo consumes another Wendigo. Number three, it cannot speak. Number four, it was never human. The appearance of a corpse walker is unforgettable and nightmarish. It resembles a monstrous mummified corpse with leathery, gray, yellowed, or molten brown thin skin over a pronounced skeleton. Bones are somewhat human in nature, though others are more beast-like. The composition of the entity depends on the feeding habits of its birthing parent, resulting in a mix of bones, teeth, and traits. It has no eyeballs, but it has long, bone-like claws and comically large feet. Poor guy, they probably teased him in school. Gathered on its travels, corpse walkers are coated in mirror, debris, biological waste, and carnage. Its squat face is shadowed by dry, gray, and brown black hair. The monster's mouth is always gaping and drooling. Wow! Its body only ever reeking of decay. Covered in bacteria, one bite or scratch could transfer a multitude of illnesses. The horror's internal anatomy only consists of a thick esophagus, extremely large stomach, and a wide, short intestine. Its throat is very stretchy, and its jaw can unhinge like a snake's. Meals that can be swallowed whole. As soon as food is digested, it is expelled from the body where the creature stands or sits. The beings are sexless and unable to reproduce. They also do not seem to need to eat, but desire to do so. The stomach never fills, only stretches. The scent of these beings extends far beyond their current positions, causing all creatures that smell its decay to flee or become on edge. If their odor does not cause panic, the sound of cracking bones and deathly pained wails does. Corpse walkers exist in a constant state of pain and misery. Though they desire to die, they do not allow themselves to be assaulted by others, as they are incessantly driven to attack and consume. When they are struck, they do not bleed or begin to perish, though they do feel agony. They can only die by falling off a mountain peak or having their body rendered to dust.
Junebug, sometimes we forget to give shout-outs. So on my end, I know Dylan's listening, Courtney, Cousin Leo, Emma, Amy, Susan, UFO Fred, Michelle. Thanks for listening. Thank y'all.
Down here on my end, we have Steve, Tim, Ryan, Roger, Seth, Terry, Dwayne, Linda, and Autumn. And I also want to send a big shout out, welcome aboard to our new listeners, Amanda, Lorna, Marie, Benjamin, Juan, Nancy, Tina, Carolyn, and Connor, welcome aboard. And thanks for listening.
So the Merriam-Webster definition of cryptid is an animal such as Sasquatch or the Loch Ness Monster that has been claimed to exist but never proven to exist. Contrary to popular belief, cryptids don't have to be supernatural, mythical, or even all that strange, though many popular cultures acquire these characteristics as their legends grow. Now, some of these that I'm talking about, or we're talking about, may not necessarily fit in the description of a cryptid, but I found these couple right here, and I think they're adorable, and I wanted to share them with you. So I'm calling them cryptids for today. And these two are out of Hawaii. Watch out for the Green Lady Child Snatcher. Dwelling in the forests of Wahiawa Gulch in Oahu, the Green Lady is a horrifying, green-skinned figure with teeth like daggers and hair draped in rotten-smelling moss and seaweed. She's said to be the ghost of a woman who died from heartbreak after her child went missing on a walk through the gulch. "Mom, I'm going to walk through the gulch." "No, you're not, Jimmy." Wandering in distress, she now spends her days in search of another child to snatch up for herself as a replacement. To this day, local children are warned not to go into the gulch, lest they get taken by the Green Lady. And next, we visit the busy little Menahuni people. These are Hawaii's hobbit people. In Hawaiian mythology, the Menahuni are tiny people who live in remote areas of the islands, spending their days building houses and other structures. These skilled craftspeople are said to have dwelled on Hawaii long before the arrival of Polynesian voyagers, building such things as the Alekoko Fish Pond on Kauai, and the ancient stone shrines on Necker Island. It's believed that the Menahuni still live deep in the forests, occasionally making their presence known by playing tricks on anyone who unknowingly ventures close to their settlements. Several sightings have been reported, but so far there's no definitive proof of these shadowy elves' existence.
This kind of goes along with Jimmy's definition of a cryptid. Everyone knows Black Panthers exist. They're a thing. But when they're seen in areas they're not supposed to be in, they become known as cryptids. Kind of weird. My friend and friend of the show, Steve, sent me some pictures of a Black Panther over in Martin County, Kentucky on Monday, February 21st, 2022. And the lady who took the pictures is a friend of Steve's. She saw the panther sitting out behind her house on a big rock up in the woods. And she snapped a couple pictures of it. And I'll try to get those pictures in the show notes in the YouTube version of this, so everyone can check that out. Martin County, Kentucky is like 10 minutes away from me, so it was pretty creepy. I guess another term for those Black Panthers is alien black cat, and I don't get that at all. They're not aliens. Or are they? But yeah, if they're not known to be in the area, they're deemed as cryptids. And the lady who took the pictures, her only comment about the panther was, "He's bigger than the last time I saw him." So that's encouraging. And here's another little story about those Black Panthers. Early in 1979, a Black Panther was reported from the Faversham area in Kent in southeast England. Students of American Big Cat sightings will know that Black Panthers are often seen in the United States, despite supposedly being extremely rare. In Britain, they should be non-existent. However, farmer Chris Flood believed he saw one on this occasion. He said, "At first,
people around here thought it was just a large domestic cat, but it was too big for that. Paw prints found on the farm and elsewhere were identified by experts as those of a dog. Despite an official pronouncement that local people could stop worrying, Mr. Flood and others who had seen the beast were not so easily satisfied. This confusion as to whether a mysterious animal is a cat or a dog often recurs. Are we perhaps dealing with some sort of hybrid? Further, big black cats were reported in southern England during 1979. Colin Carter was walking on the South Downs near Eastbourne in Sussex at the end of June when a black cat-like creature the size of a pony crossed his path and disappeared into the undergrowth. Early in September, John and Francis Clark were walking in Tilgate Forest near Crawley in Sussex, 25 to 30 miles from the site of the previous sighting, when they spotted a large cat-like animal standing motionless about 75 to 100 yards away. It watched them for several seconds, and then, when John whistled, it bounded into the undergrowth. The couple described it as 2 to 2.5 feet tall, with a small head, pointed ears, and a long tail. It was dark in color, either brown or black. In Surrey, panther-like creatures were still being seen as the 1980s dawned. On the 27th of June, 1980, Mrs. Vivian Wilkinson looked out a window at her East Horsley home around 5 p.m. and saw a tawny cat at the bottom of her garden. As it loped across the lawn and through a gaping fence, she saw that it had a thick tail that reached the ground and that it was somewhat taller than a red setter dog. There were other sightings in the country in the 1980s too. During the second half of 1980, for example, there were numerous sightings of what would have been a panther in the Wolverhampton area of the West Midlands. It was seen in July by a school teacher walking near a disused railway line who watched it for nearly 5 minutes from a distance of 50 yards. The brown animal had a round, cat-like head, pricked ears, short, thick legs, and a heavy tail held low. Following further reports, including one of an attack on a dog that was being walked by a child, the superintendent of Dudley Zoo, Mike Williams, visited the area accompanied by his senior cat keeper. They were fortunate enough to see the animal, but could get no nearer than about 300 yards. After following the animal for 15 minutes, they lost it, and a police search of the area proved futile. Mr. Williams would not commit himself to a positive identification of the animal as being a panther. He told authors, "Both Alan and myself were of the opinion that the animal we saw was much too large to be a fox, and had a lot of typical cat characteristics about it, but we could not get close enough, and we could not give the police a positive identification. If it had been a large brown dog, it would have surely been found during the police search." So yeah, black panthers, alien big cats. These guys pop up in places all the time where they're not supposed to be. And a while back on the show, we talked about a sighting our listener Tim had of a big black panther right here in my neck of the woods, a mile up the road from me. So be on the lookout.
Here's another creature that may or may not exist. In Cherokee mythology, the monster is the cat-like embodiment of a female onlooker cursed by tribal elders as punishment for hiding beneath the pelt of a large wildcat to witness a sacred ceremony. The Wampus Cat has been associated in several southeastern tribal beliefs as a shapeshifter. Later, various towns in the United States reported sightings as early as the 1920s of the Wampus Cat, which would kill livestock. During the 1920s and 30s, newspapers reported of a Wampus Cat killing livestock in North Carolina to Georgia, and such sightings continued even into the 60s. When one was sighted, the townspeople would institute curfews and arm themselves against the creature. The Wampus Cat varies widely in appearance, but is always feline in nature. It is usually depicted similar to a cougar or mountain lion, with light tan or yellow fur, has yellow eyes, and often has six legs as opposed to four. According to locals in Conway, Arizona, the cat is described as a mountain lion with six legs, four for running and two for fighting. In Clark Ford, Idaho, the cat is described as having a ball-like formation at the end of its tail, seemingly covered in sharp quills or spikes. And coincidentally, my cat's here meowing right now. What do you want?
What is the difference between a Wampus Cat and a Catawampus? A Catawampus is a whimsical creature that dashes through the skies, often chasing a bird or a drifting feather. Catawampi, the plural form, are winged felines with twitching tails, living in high elevations. They swoop at small prey, play with falling objects, and skirt away from large predators like wolves. The animals live inside of hollowed-out trees, abandoned bird nests, and atop thick branches. When resting, they can be seen stretching their long bodies and extending their wings or sharpening their nails on bark. If agitated or frisky, the cat's hair will fluff, its tail swishing and ears flat against its skull. After a rainy day, Catawampi bathe extensively, sometimes gingerly, dipping a paw into a puddle, carefully washing their face, ears, and whiskers. The felines spend most of their day and night sleeping, their wings and tail curled snugly around their body, and their kittens, if present. Catawampi are carnivorous, eating small prey such as squirrels, lizards, birds, mice, insects, fish, frogs, and small fish. They can eat regular fish and small fish. If the cats are being hunted, they will flee to high locations, using their claws to skirt up trees. If a predator follows upward, the feline will fly from the tree or perch to a different branch until the creature tires and gives up. In dire circumstances, the Catawampus will use their teeth and claws to defend themselves. With lives similar to domesticated cats, Catawampi can lead lives that lasts from 13 to 17 years.
Holy mackerels, this one's a doozy. Drop bears are believed by some to be a hoax. These creatures from Australia are described as being a vicious and carnivorous version of the typically docile koala. Drop bears are large, vicious marsupials that live in the treetops until they see humans, their prey, walk underneath, and then drop down onto the victim's head. The Australian Museum describes the drop bear as having coarse orange fur with some darker mottled patterning. They are around the size of a leopard or a large dog. They are heavily built and have powerful forearms for climbing and holding onto its prey. They are thought to live in the Great Dividing Range in southeastern Australia, with some reports from southeast South Australia, Mount Lofty Ranges, and Kangaroo Island. That sounds fun. There are several methods to avoid being attacked by drop bears. Now write these down, fellas, you never know. when you're going to encounter one of these little guys. These methods include putting forks in your hair, spreading toothpaste or Vegemite behind your ears or armpits, urinating on yourself, and only speaking in an Australian accent in English. That's called the drop bear out of Australia.
The devil dog is a creature similar to the chupacabra, perhaps the result of interbreeding with a large canine. They are most recognized for their stark white and dirty yellow fur, which is matted, filthy, and thick in winter. In the spring, they shed their coats, trails of hair, making them easier to follow. Tracks are very rare, as the beasts do not like to get wet, avoiding mud, rain, and water sources in general. Nevertheless, they leave three toed prints that look like a combination of an aves and a canine's. They are comparable in appearance to wolves. During the day, high-pitched yips and barks echo in the woodlands as packs communicate with one another. At night, when the creatures are not seen, they can be heard releasing chilling screams that resemble that of a shrieking woman. Many cultures view hearing a devil dog as a bad omen. When hunting in the dark, the beast's eyes glow an eerie red, slit-like irises following their target's movements, silent as it listens to its brethren for information and signals. The most striking aspect of a devil dog's anatomy is its tongue. The muscle is 2.2 times the length of its head and is covered in bristles. A blood drinker, the bristles allow blood to pool between and under the cell's grooves, pulling much more liquid into the mouth than an average dog's would. Randomly dispersed throughout the tongue are also sucker-like tubes that repeatedly relax and contract during feeding, siphoning blood through the tongue and into the stomach. These tubes are hard to see with the naked eye. In addition to their unique tongues, devil dogs have several sharp curved fangs, which help it to tear and pierce flesh. The dog's long bushy tails and elongated toes permit it to stand on the edge of its environment, moving with certainty and balance.
Tatsel worms are lizard-like creatures that are supposed to inhabit the most isolated regions of the Alps. Although accounts of their size and appearance vary, they are typically said to be around 2 to 5 feet in length, with a broad cat-like head and a wide gaping mouth. Their forelimbs are short and armed with long claws, but they have no hind legs, and instead, their bodies taper into a long snake-like tail. Numerous sightings of the creatures, which are known as tatsel worms in Germany, arasus in France, stalin worms in Switzerland, other names in Austria and Italy, have been made all over the Alps, including a recent spate of sightings reported in Italy's Il Giorno newspaper as recently as 2009. Oh, now I introduce you to Mrs. Mapinguari. The Mapinguari is a large ape-like creature said to inhabit the rainforest straddling the border between Brazil and Bolivia. According to local folklore, the Mapinguari stands about 8 feet tall, has a rough, tough, and apparently bulletproof covering of scales on its back, thick red fur on its head and belly, and long curved claws, and, if all the stories are to be believed, a second mouth in the center of the stomach. That would be perfect if you're at the movies or something, because you got your popcorn, you got your junior mints, your snow caps, and your drink, you know. All right. When approached by humans, the Mapinguari is said to rear up on its hind legs like a bear and can supposedly produce a foul-smelling scent to ward off potential hunters. As recently as 2007, A sighting was reported in the New York Times. Oh, what do we have here? Mr. Altamaha. The Altamaha is a 20 to 30 foot long river monster with large flippers and a seal-like snout that is said to inhabit the mouth of the Altamaha River near Darien, Georgia. Although numerous accounts of sightings of the Altamaha have apparently been made over the years, the fact that Darien was founded as New Inverness by a band of Scottish Highlanders in 1736 seems to suggest that the legend is probably nothing more than a descendant of the Scots settlers' tales of the Loch Ness Monster.
Ever since the 1930s, people have been attempting to capture the Loch Ness Monster on film. The archives are full of alleged photographic evidence of the existence of the monster, but how much of it is genuine? And what does it tell us about the monster? By Adrian Shine. Thanks, Adrian. The explosion of interest in what may or may not lurk in the dark depths of Loch Ness was sparked off by the McKay sighting on April 14, 1933. Since then, the volume of evidence has grown steadily. There were 50 other sightings in that year alone, and has been sustained ever since, with many more sightings, photographs, film, and other evidence as attempts have been made to investigate the monster. In addition to the better view afforded by tree filling on the north side of the loch, press interest led to many sightings being documented. The two factors together could account for the apparent suddenness of the phenomenon. Once Loch Ness was publicly known to contain a mystery, people would obviously be on the lookout for any signs of the unusual, and by the same token, the interest would induce strong expectation and powerful suggestion. The major difficulty in evaluating eyewitness accounts and evidence is one of subjectivity. An honest man may easily be mistaken or fooled. A dishonest one is quite likely to give a good impression, and an educated one may be imaginative. The fact is that without very specific experience, it is extremely difficult to judge time, size, distance, or speed with any accuracy, especially over water. By pressing a witness to commit himself to such details, the investigator is inadvertently contriving to make an honest man appear a liar or a fool. So, it is impossible to construct a particularly accurate picture of what has been seen by using this kind of material. The loch itself presents problems because it plays tricks on the eyes. It is a large mass of water, sometimes completely calm in a way that the sea, for example, rarely is, and its high shorelines cast deep shadows and reflections. In these conditions, you can get a visual impression totally out of proportion to the actual cause of small animals, water birds, boat wakes, and wind. The wakes from boats passing through the loch, for example, can be reflected from the shores to form a standing wave in the center of the loch after the particular boat has passed out of sight. Despite these problems, thousands of eyewitness sightings are now on record. Thanks to the press, individual authors, and investigative organizations such as the Loch Ness Investigation Bureau, which was active between 1962 and 1972, the descriptions are remarkably consistent and describe a long-necked, humpbacked creature that sometimes moves at speed, both with neck raised and lowered, and at other times simply appears for a while and then submerges quietly. The first chronicler of the Loch Ness sightings was Lieutenant Commander Rupert Gould, who, in his book The Loch Ness Monster, 1934, described 42 sightings from 1923 to 1933 in a well-presented case. He felt that the creature was an isolated specimen that had become trapped in the loch.
He was followed by Mrs. Constance White, wife of the manager of the Culloden Canal. Her book, More Than a Legend, published in 1957, contained references to over 60 sightings. She established that the phenomenon had not ceased after 1934, as some had believed, and that sometimes more than one animal was seen at a time, suggesting a resident population. More recent authors include Tim Dinsdale, Ted Holliday, Peter Costello, and Nick Witchell, all of whom have added more examples of eyewitness evidence. Much of this evidence is drawn from the extensive files of the Loch Ness Investigation Bureau, which collected reports at the Loch side. The sheer volume of eyewitness evidence from Loch Ness and its intensity suggests there is a population of large animals in the water. This and some unexplained scientific findings, particularly through sonar, are all we can go by at the present. Surface behavior is so obviously uncharacteristic that no real pattern can be established. There are more sightings in the summer months, particularly at the mouth of the rivers, and certainly more on calm, hot days. But weather conditions and the fact that summer marks the height of the tourist season must be taken into account. For decades, Loch Ness has hosted a variety of expeditions in search of this legendary monster. Most notably, teams from Oxford and Cambridge, Birmingham University, Vickers Oceanics, and the Academy of Applied Sciences have all produced results that they consider indicate the presence of an animate contact larger than a salmon and displaying movement and diving rates different from those expected of a fish. Some of the results are inconclusive, others are positive.
The Grafton Monster, also known as the Beast of Grafton, is a large humanoid cryptid that's said to stalk the forests outside the town of Grafton, West Virginia, a former railroad boomtown located in the United States. It was originally sighted in 1964 by Robert Cockrell, who worked as a reporter for the Grafton Sentinel. According to Cockrell, the monster was huge, had no visible head, and had slick, seal-like skin. His account was dismissed by the editors at his work, but news of the monster soon gained popularity throughout West Virginia, leading to a large search aimed at finding this creature. Today, the monster is still a popular cryptid in the area, and Grafton is a tourist stop for cryptid enthusiasts. The monster is claimed to be a large humanoid bipedal creature. I looked up this word. You could say a bipedal. I like bipedal. A bipedal creature with no visible head and covered in slick, white, seal-like skin. It's unclear, though, if it actually doesn't have a head or if its head is simply located close to his chest. In an article in the Grafton Sentinel, published on June 18, 1964, an anonymous teenager claimed the creature was 9 feet tall and about 4 feet wide. Now, here's the sighting in 1964 by Robert Cockrell. So, around 11 p.m., Robert Cockrell, a reporter for the newspaper, was driving along the Tiger River on Route 119, known as Riverside Drive, on his way home from work. There, Cockrell suddenly encountered a white, large creature on the right-hand side of the road, which was the side that the Tiger River was located. According to Cockrell's account, the creature was lumbering around the side of the road while a low whistling noise was being emitted from further away in the direction of the river. Cockrell, at the time, had no explanation for the noise, but later on, ufologist Gray Barker, believing the creature to be extraterrestrial in origin, of course, suggested that the noise was being emitted from the creature's spaceship. Oof! Surprised by the encounter, Cockrell initially slowed down, and he was able to see that the creature was very large and appeared to be made entirely of muscle. It also had white seal-like fur and disturbingly didn't have a visible head. The creature moved quickly out of view, and upon realizing that the white obstruction was a living creature, he quickly accelerated down the road until he got home. Once home, Cockrell called two of his friends, Jerry Morse and Jim Mouser. Cockrell explained his sighting to them and asked them to come with him to the location of the sighting in order to investigate further. They agreed, but when they returned to the site, all they were able to find was trampled grass and a low whistling sound that seemed to follow them around the site. The next day at work, Cockrell mentioned this to his editor of the Grafton Sentinel of what he had seen, but the editor did not take the sighting seriously. Cockrell assumed that nothing more would come of this sighting after that point. Cockrell's friends, however, were fascinated with the idea of a monster on the loose and went around town telling as many people as they could. In very short time, monster hunting parties formed, predominantly made up of local teens armed with baseball bats or whatever they could find. That's a nice way to greet your new friend. These roving groups of teens scoured Riverside Drive near where Cockrell had initially seen the creature, and soon sightings were being reported. Spurred by the commotion and by the new sighting, the Grafton Sentinel interviewed some of the teenagers and produced an article about the creature on June 18, 1964, titled Teenage Monster Hunting Party's Latest Activity on Grafton Scene. More than 20 sightings were reported from this monster hunt, which Robert Cockrell interviewed in detail. Below are two of the alleged sightings. I have seen the creature called the Grafton Monster several times when I was a young man, and it is very real. My first encounter, I was with my father cutting wood. We had finished and we were loading the truck. When our two dogs started barking, we stood there and listened. Something was walking, getting closer. My dad told me to get the gun from the cab. He carried a double-barrel 10-gauge with buckshot. Whatever had picked up its pace and continued towards us. All we knew for sure was it was big and wasn't scared of us, the dogs or the chainsaws. It stopped about 50 yards away from us in the trees and went quiet. My dad pulled both hammers back and stood in front of me, told me to be ready. The next thing that happened, I'll never forget. It stepped out, looked at us, took three strides in our direction, turned and walked back into the tree line. That was my first sighting of the beast, and I'll never forget it. What happened to my accent? My second encounter was about 2 months later at night, fishing alone. I spotted him on the opposite bank, and I got the hell out of there. What are all these hunters doing running away from their... Anyway, I saw the monster near the river early in the morning. It saw me and instantly froze. It did not move. I was fishing at the time and left all my gear there and started to run away. As I ran and I turned, I saw that it too turned away and started running off. As I got near my truck and began opening the door, I heard a whooshing sound and a bright light appear above the tree line. And I drove off and got my gear 2 days later. Oh, so maybe it was a little spacecraft. I don't know. But that one there is called the Grafton Monster.
And the guys from Mountain Monsters have been covering the Grafton Monster all this season. Season 6, I think it is. You can see that on the Travel Channel to get more information on the Grafton Monster. And in the meantime, you'll be supporting the Ames team at Mountain Monsters. They're a nice bunch of folks. Apple devils are small species of Bigfoot that can run incredibly fast on bipedal legs. I'm going to go with bipedal too, Jimmy. Unlike similar animals, wild reds are vegetarian, preferring fruit above all else. They have a distinctively sour, rotten odor that is produced from small glands under the arms and neck.
This musk is transferred throughout the hair during grooming. Apple devils' bright, ruddy brown tresses cover most of their body, aside from the typical bare places like face, hands, and feet, forming a chin curtain and patches on the upper lip and knuckles, which expose very little of its dark tan complexion. The beasts do not loudly call to one another or utilize knocking, but communicate through soft, deep harumphs. Though they are not as complex, large, or intelligent as other big feet, they have an extraordinary power. They can become invisible when frightened or surprised. Wild reds have excellent night vision. Almost all their activity takes place from sunset to the a.m. hours after the subsequent sunrise. Their sight during the day is impaired. When faced with bright lights or unexpected shadows, they flee in terror, knocking over any object in their path.
Look who we have here, Mr. Dobar Chu. The Dobar Chu, or water hound, is a legendary otter-like creature that supposedly lives in isolated freshwater and rivers in Ireland, usually described as a half-dog, half-fish hybrid with a long, snaking body covered in thick fur. The Dobar Chu is large and heavy-set, but can move very fast both in water and on land, even, according to one story, being able to keep up with a galloping horse. Sightings of this creature date back several centuries in Ireland, and there are at least two gravestones dating back as far as 1722 of people who were reportedly attacked and killed by a Dobar Chu. Come visit us, Dobar Chu!
In freshwater basins, mysterious groups lurk, watching silently, bitterly, able to stand and walk like a man, but looking more like a fish. The Monongi are an ancient aquatic civilization. They are a vibrantly colored species. Their scales are an olive hue intermingled with shades of green, their belly tapering into a shimmering silver and backs decorated with dark green stripes, while males' fins are pale green and females a vibrant red. Both sexes display small, hauntingly red eyes with large dark pupils. Though they have a very fish-like face, the Monongi have an excellent range of facial expressions. When angered or irritated, their lips pull back menacingly, bearing thin pointed teeth, and their fins raise and fan out, making them appear larger, more ferocious. When saddened or in submission, the creatures tuck their heads in and tighten their fins, thinning out their forms. The fish folk are not very tall, growing only 2 to 3 feet high, but they have powerful arms and legs, each with 5 webbed digits. Their hands resemble fins, wispy and semi-transparent, though they can grasp objects. It is with a clumsy grip. Aided by a powerful tail, the Monongi are agile swimmers, able to fluidly navigate through tight quarters and rushing currents. An anomaly, they have a small pair of land-breathing lungs and large gills behind rows of thin ribs. Although they can survive out of water, they are not as well suited to the environment, finding it awkward to navigate dry land. Out of water, Monongi walk slowly with a gait similar to that of a man wearing heavy flippers. Here, they cannot hunt as effectively.
Next, I'd like to share with you some legendary monsters of Africa. The Ninki Nanka is a legendary creature in West African folklore. Descriptions of the creature vary, but most contend that the animal is reptilian and possibly dragon-like. According to tradition, the Ninki Nanka lives in the swamps of West Africa. The animal is said to be extremely large and very dangerous. It is said that when children get too confident and feel they can disobey their parents and go into the swamp, they will be taken by the Ninki Nanka. This creature's tales were never recorded in any sort of non-modern text, but the story of it has spread from tribe to tribe all over Africa. There's even a song called Ninki Nanka on the album Casamance au Clair de Lune from 1984 by the Senegalese music group Tore Kunda, a group of dragon hunters from the Center of Fortean Zoology. I want to be a dragon hunter from the Center of Fortean Zoology. So they went to Gambia in the summer of 2006 to investigate the Ninki Nanka and take testimony from those who have claimed to have seen the mythical creature. One interviewee who claimed to have had an encounter with the Ninki Nanka said it looked similar to an image of a Chinese dragon. The expedition, known as the J.T. Downs Memorial Gambia Expedition 2006, received a fair amount of media attention, including coverage in a BBC online article. And next, we have the Mokeli Mabebi. And that's a cryptid resembling a dinosaur from the Congo River region. The name means one who stops the flow of rivers, referring to its size. Dozens of expeditions have sought to find this huge creature, but come back with only secondhand accounts and mysterious footprints. The 1985 Disney film Baby is based on the legend of the Mokele Mbembe. How about this fella, the Tikoloshe? The Tikoloshe is an evil-spirited gremlin in Zulu mythology. A shaman may send a Tikoloshe to vex his enemies, causing anything from harmless fright to illness or death. Tikoloshes are described as short, hairy, humanoid figures. So that's why that guy was running after me, calling me a Tikoloshe. Anyway, they're described as short, hairy, humanoid figures that can render themselves invisible by swallowing a pebble. All the better to sneak up on their victims. And there's a couple, there's still three cryptids out of Africa.
I got a report back on July 18th of 2014 of a possible goat man sighting. This guy was out riding his four-wheeler on the night of Sunday, July 13th of 2014. He was out just watching the sunset and the stars and just riding out in the hills. And he said his four-wheeler lights illuminated for about 2 to 3 seconds while coming off a hill into a field of what looked like, at first, he thought was a deer running. It was gray, very gray, like a woodsy tree bark gray, but it wasn't bouncing like deer do. It was just moving left to right, upright like a man. It had thin spire horns and looked more goat-like. The way it moved, no bouncing or shaking. I'm very unnerved. I slammed on the brakes and was scared to go on for about a minute. Then my girlfriend said, "Get us out of here." So I roared out while both of us kept looking back as well as all around for miles. She did not see it, luckily. It must have been some kind of dull gray, two-legged, freak mutant, weird, antlered, deformed deer. He got home and Googled Goat Man to see if there was such a thing. And he watched a video of it, and he realized that's what he saw. He said it was just running from left to right, about 150 feet in front of him. No bobbing or weaving, just straight across from his headlight beam. Head and shoulders above the weeds from the tall grass in the field. Like it was just kind of gliding across the field. But he never did get a good look to see if it had two legs or four. And he measured it to stand at about the height of his shoulders. And he is about 6 feet tall, so around 5 feet or so. Pretty creepy.
This cryptid might be my favorite because I'm hoping that he's really a werewolf. A hairy humanoid with canine features, the Beast of Bray Road has been sighted in Wisconsin dating back to 1936 on a rural road outside of Elkhorn, Wisconsin. More recent sightings in the 1980s and 90s placed the creature in Racine, Walworth, and Jefferson counties. Those who have seen the beast describe him as eating or hunting, scavenging, also known as man-wolf, bear-wolf, and indigenous dog-man, and is said to be around 6 feet tall with gray and brown fur. Its face resembles that of a wolf with shiny yellow eyes and pointed ears. Its body, though furry, looks like a muscular man. The creature is said to run and walk on all four of its legs or just its hind legs, and has been spied sitting on its haunches and kneeling like a man. Some believe it is a werewolf, others that it is a Bigfoot, and some believe that it is a yet unidentified species. Though it has never attacked anyone, some witnesses claim that it has acted aggressively at them, running at them and jumping on their vehicles. Some researchers consider the Beast of Bray Road to be identical to a kind of Wisconsin Bigfoot that locals call the Bluff Monster or the Eddie. Others, including many Native Americans, believe it is to be the Wendigo, which was often spied in Minnesota. Others believe that it has simply been misidentified and it is a wolf, a bear, or a large feral dog. It's a werewolf. This werewolf-like creature has been portrayed regularly in the media since the first sightings and even had a low-budget movie based on its legend. The number of sightings in the late 80s and 90s prompted a local newspaper, the Walworth County Week, to assign reporter Linda Godfrey to cover the story. Initially, she was skeptical, but soon became convinced of its authenticity and later wrote a book called The Beast of Bray Road, Tailing Wisconsin's Werewolf. He's a werewolf. Thank you.
Hey, I think we're going to stop right there. There's just so many cryptids. Golly, this was a long one. We sure hope you enjoyed Cryptopalooza. We had a blast researching all these weird, crazy cryptids. God bless you, and we'll see you next week.